You're listening to the official podcast of Asbury University, produced by students with God-honoring conversations that inform, edify, and encourage. This is Asbury. We explore culture and current topics through a Christian worldview, promoting a well-balanced life, and we empower our community to belong, become, and be set apart. I'm your host, Abby Laub. Welcome to This is Asbury.
Hello, and welcome to This is Asbury. I'm your guest host, Dr. Paul Nesselrode. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with author and early church historian, Dr. Nadja Williams. She's recently published a book entitled Cultural Christians in the Early Church. And as a guest of the Honors Program, Dr. Williams has come to campus to give a talk about what she's found in her research. So welcome, Nadja. Thanks for taking a few minutes to sit down with us and talk about your work.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. So your fascinating book is about the surprising truth, perhaps, to me at least, that what we might term today cultural Christianity is not merely a function of modern life. In fact, it was also part of the early church, both before Constantine, during those first few centuries that sometimes featured intense persecution, and then also after Constantine, when Rome was, quote-unquote, Christianized. And so chapter by chapter, you go through and show us how versions of unholy living practices that Christians are tempted by and end up accommodating to today were present in maybe different forms in the early church. Is that a fair characterization? And how would you sort of describe better, perhaps, what you're accomplishing in your book?
Yeah, so I'm looking at assumptions. Up until a little over a year ago, I was teaching in the Bible Belt at a state university and, of course, attending church in the Bible Belt. And an assumption that I noticed both my students and people I knew from church had was that early Christians were so different from us, that they were holier, they were more countercultural, because it cost you something to be a Christian in this age of persecution. I mean, you literally could lose your life over your beliefs, which is something just kind of unfathomable today for us in modern America, in our comfortable lives. And yet, my point was that cultural Christianity, something that we see today in parts of the country where, like, everybody goes to church, right? It's just a normal thing. And yet, you could see the phenomenon of cultural Christianity, even in the early church, at this time when there was no benefit for you, like, in practical terms, for being a Christian. But the point is, what I argue is that culture is what we live in. It's the air we breathe. I cite another historian who describes it as secondhand smoke. And so because of that, you just can't avoid it. And so cultural Christianity, it may seem shocking, but it's always the default in any period of the history of the church.
Yeah, and but it's easily missed because it's perhaps not doesn't come through the lives of the saints, perhaps, and things like that. So as I think about the fact that we can't help but be cultural beings, and as I reflect on the topics covered in your book, my categorizing mind wonders if we could think about maybe at least three different ways this secondhand smoke of culture seems to seep into our lives of faith. I thought about the gospel plus something, like maybe nationalism, God and country, so where you sort of, there's nothing wrong with patriotism, but does it sort of, do we add that, and does that become a problem sometimes? The gospel minus something, perhaps the restraints on sexual behavior, or the gospel, a third category might be the gospel watered down, like where we compartmentalize faith and we say, well, I really can't do this as in my job. I'm not expected to think. I mean, it's just I can't imagine how I could sort of act Christianly in this way in my work. So all three of those could be kind of different ways of accommodating to culture. Does that fit well with what you found? And if I can add a follow-up, if it does, I'm curious if a student of history might say, yeah, and one of those seems to be more pernicious than the others, or more pervasive, or more having more impact.
I really like this categorization. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but it does certainly fit the patterns that I've found. I wouldn't say that any one of these is necessarily more prevalent, but depending on a particular Christian's circumstances, different ones might prevail. I think of Tim Keller's ministry, which was so much about combating the gospel plus something, just the idea that we always want to add something. Although also some of the gospel minus something really comes through, like you mentioned the sexual ethics today, that's a really common problem where Christians can say, like, well, you know, we need to update the gospel to the 21st century. It's like, I have news for you. The gospel is timeless. That's the whole point, like God's truth does not need updating, quote unquote. But perhaps especially for anybody who ends up working in a setting that is not a Christian setting, the compartmentalization aspect maybe is the most kind of the easiest to fall into in the modern life, because we don't live in, like, believe it or not, America is not a Christian nation. I know, like, we'd like to think, some people would like to think that it is, but really it's not. And so the question is, depending on where you work, and especially if you're a college student right now at Asbury and you're thinking, like, okay, I'm in this beautiful setting where I'm learning to, like, bring God into every aspect of your life. Well, that might not be the case when you're out of college. And the question is, how do you keep the gospel in front of you when you're working at a job that's very much in the secular world? That's hard. I know I struggled with that teaching at a state university, the question of how do I make it clear who I am in the classroom, but also realizing like that was a state university. And ultimately, it involved telling my students at the beginning of the semester, I would usually say, like, here's who I am. Obviously, like, I respect that most of you perhaps are not Christians, but just so you know where I'm coming from, and that's, like, that's my assumptions. That's how I operate.
Yeah, well, you've, as a person who spent my professional career in Christian higher education, I mean, you've put your finger on something there very important about how to help our students sort of transport into what will then for them be foreign space. Yeah, so maybe that can be a future book, is to help us think about how to do that better. Your last chapter warns us that, because my mind goes to this, running away from culture. Let's just sort of remove ourselves. Let's get out of the secondhand smoke. Why isn't that a solution? Why shouldn't we just separate ourselves and then purify ourselves in that manner?
It really gets back to assumptions. So if your assumption is that everybody else is the problem, like everybody else is the sinner, and you could be holy as long as you separate yourself from all these other sinners and problem solved. And by the way, the modern world makes it possible in a much more comfortable way than antiquity, where you had to go into the desert and be really uncomfortable for decades, as some desert saints did. Whereas today you can just like lock yourself in and, you know, live off Uber Eats or something. But the point is, if you look at sin, the reality, the really painful reality that we struggle with, and really it's kind of uncomfortable to admit, is every single one of us is a sinner in need of God's grace. And if every single one of us is a sinner, then guess what? If you run away from culture, if you run away from other sinners, guess who's coming with you? You and your sin. And then you're all alone trying to deal with it without the sanctifying aspect of the church. So yes, it's easy to criticize others and say they distract us from holy living, but really sinners too. And that's where it gets, that's the reality of it, that we need other Christians to encourage us.
Yeah, that pries right into that assumption, that self-serving assumption that we all tend to have. Excellent. Okay, I'm going to ask this tongue-in-cheek, but so one potential takeaway from your book is that we should just all feel a good bit better about our own failures to live fully into the gospel message and content ourselves with the realization that we're in good company with many Christians down through the ages. I'm guessing that's not your takeaway point. Tell us, how should we respond to your work?
It's really uncomfortable to think about ourselves as sinners. And I say this as somebody who spent most of my Christian life in the PCA. Like, this is, you know, the Reformed world where you'd think people would be even more comfortable than anywhere else to think about themselves as sinners. And still, it's uncomfortable. But that's really the reality. If we realize that all Christians, all of us, are on this journey of sanctification, then it should not surprise us that both early Christians needed that, needed God's grace, needed to pursue a life of sanctification. And we do too. And I think this is actually really encouraging. It's not that we are better or worse than Christians in any time period. It's just that all of us need God's grace.
Last question. As we move more and more into a post-Christian world, one recent that comes to mind, a non-Christian writer, at least at the time she was non-Christian, I don't know, but she was bemoaning the demonstrable and seemingly inevitable slide of Western culture back into pagan ethics. And she wonders if we ever actually tried the Christianity that we're so busy currently rejecting. From your work, how would you respond to that idea?
That is something that does trouble me a great deal. And I have a book coming out this fall with IVP that looks at that issue in connection with how we talk about mothers and children. And if you've seen, like, there's so much snide language in the media about how, like, all those headings, like, women who have children don't get as wealthy or not as happy and so on and so forth. And it's one thing to debunk this, which it people like Brad Wilcox have debunked this. Like, there's actual data showing that mothers are consistently, like, happier and more fulfilled than people who never have children or never get married, for example. But that's not the point. The bigger issue is the values, that we have a society that values work, values economic productivity over image bearers. And that's where the pagan kind of repaganizing language is really disturbing, because we're putting a price on human beings. And as Christians, of course, we need to remember that's where the Imago Dei comes in. And it's a reminder that any kind of valuing of humanity that we've seen over the past 2,000 years has been the product of Christianity. Whenever you're wondering, like, what have Christians done for this world? That's what they have done. 2,000 years of arguing in a way that no other religion, no other culture has traditionally argued, that every single human being, regardless of their economic productivity, ability or disability, gender, age, whatever, every single human being is a treasure in God's eyes. There is no other system in world history that says this.
Yeah, and this is going to be featured in your next book. Do you have a working title for it, or a publication date? Tell us just a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so the title is Mothers, Children, and the Body Politic, and it's coming out October 15th.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for your work. And blessings on you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This is Asbury. To learn more about Asbury University, visit asbury.edu.